You're listening to After Images, a podcast for cinephiles that takes a deep dive into moving images. Each episode features a special guest who is invited to explore a film of their choice. After Images is hosted by film writers Franck Bouleg and Marisa C. Hayes. On the 15th episode of our podcast, we welcome author William Boyle to discuss Sidney Pollack's 1969 American psychological drama, They Shoot Horses, Don't They?, starring Jane Fonda and Michael Sarrazin as the story's central protagonists, Gloria and Robert. The film is set against the backdrop of the Great Depression and depicts a dance marathon in California during which the contestants hope to win a $1,500 cash prize. As the marathon drags on, participants are progressively eliminated, falling, sometimes violently, one after the other. The dancers are pushed to the breaking point under the complacent eyes of the audience. Dark and nihilistic, They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Offers a penetrating critique of the American dream, among other possible readings.
William Boyle is the author of 8 works of fiction set in the southern Brooklyn neighborhood where he was born and raised. He writes a film column for Southwest Review called I Wake Up Streaming. He currently lives in Oxford, Mississippi.
Welcome, William Boyle, to After Images podcast. We're so happy to have you with us today to discuss Sidney Pollack's 1969 film, They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here and great to meet you both. I'm just excited to be talking about this movie.
Thanks so much. We always like to begin the podcast by asking our guests, why did you choose this film and what does it mean to you?
I think when I got your message and you talked about choosing a film that had kind of imprinted itself on my consciousness, and you know, I think on a different day I could have chosen 100 other films. There are so many that have had a massive impact on me. I was drawn to this one, I think, because it did have a big impact on me at a fairly young age. And it's also, you know, it's based on a great novel that I love and that I reread often. That's kind of thought of as a great American crime novel, even though it kind of stretches the boundaries of that a little bit, I think. So I just thought it was something I felt like that represented me in some way, or represented my taste and my own work, and you know, just it's had a major impact on me. And it's it's a film that I think about a lot. I think, you know, there are those films that you just and books and albums, of course, that you just kind of are always in your mind and you're always returning to, whether it's the whole thing or scenes or images or performances. And this is one of those movies for me. It's just, you know, something that I'm thinking about all the time. I'm interested in the art of adaptation, certainly. And I think it's a really interesting adaptation of a book that is, you know, pretty spare, and the movie's kind of much bigger than the book. It's one of my favorites and just kind of is always in my mind, I think. And it also, I think it kind of hits on so many things that I love about literature and art in general, but, you know, in particular kind of crime related stuff or crime adjacent stuff. It's about desperate people in a desperate situation, which is what I'm always drawn to. I love claustrophobic settings. I love, you know, kind of one location films, you know, so that's definitely, I think, some stuff that makes it super present in my mind a lot.
Yes, the film plays with this unity of space in which the characters are almost trapped. In what way does that increase the interest of the audience, you think, for what is happening, and what sort of mood does it create?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. It's an interesting choice in the film because the book is not quite as tight on that space. It doesn't open there. It opens in, it's much more of a Hollywood novel, really. I mean, it's, you know, that's not as it's under the surface a little bit in the movie, but the book starts away from the dance, and Gloria and Robert meet, out on the street, and they eventually wind up going to the dance. I mean, it's all told in flashback. But the movie, I was just actually listening. I was kind of cramming, doing my homework before this and listening to Sydney Pollack's commentary track on the Blu-ray. And, he talked about that being a specific, important choice to keep it in this one space and to have it feel kind of like the end of the world, the end of America. It's out on this pier in Hollywood. I think you really do feel that in the movie. It's got this quality of being at the end of something. Just adds that claustrophobia, I think, definitely adds to the tension and the sense of desperation. And I don't know. I don't know if that totally answers that question, but.
It doesn't, but I had the feeling watching the film that they are somehow trapped in some sort of an eternal present in the, but at the same time you've got these flashbacks and flash forwards that somehow take you out of this space but leading nowhere.
Yeah, that's really, I mean, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, they definitely do feel trapped, and the flash forwards are really interesting in the film, because the book, again, the book is his trial, basically, is the kind of present, and then the action of the dance marathon is all in flashback, essentially. And the movie messes with that, and the movie has time, what Sydney Pollack calls in the commentary track, time present and time future. But they had a hard time kind of selling the flash forwards, and it was only when they cut it out of the movie, and I think they only when they previewed it and people laughed at the ending, did they put the flash forwards back in, because they felt like it gave the audience more of a grounding in why he was doing what he was doing at the end. But yeah, it's definitely a sense of being trapped. And I think, one of the other things he says in that commentary track is it's hard not to be kind of seduced by the symbolism of it all. And I think, that's obviously something the film is kind of, I think even treading on a little bit more of kind of dangerous ground with than the book, because it does it. I mean, I think in Pauline Kael's review, I remember she said it had like a it was adapted with a sledgehammer touch. It's kind of a mixed review. It's not super negative, but there are things she doesn't like about it. So I think, yeah, that kind of sense of this is representative of what life is, what the world is. It's being trapped, doing useless things over and over again, where there's no payoff.
There's a really powerful moment in the film. I remember when they're on one of their brief breaks and they kind of leave the public area, and someone is opening the door to the outside for a cigarette break. And our lead character, Robert, is able to see the ocean outside. And the guy who works there, quickly closes the door and says, "Get out of here." But for that brief moment, he has this vision of something outside of this really closed-in, dark kind of space. And having just finished your book, Shoot the Moonlight Out, it occurs to me how much these people are also really on the cusp of something else. They're all from the same neighborhood in Brooklyn, but the city is just beyond. And that they have something within reach, but they just can't quite get there for the time being, or they're navigating their way to working towards that. So I saw a lot of parallels between your book and the film, and I'm just curious how much of the films you see, do you feel they're important for your writing? And I imagine they're there somewhere, but to what extent are you aware of it?
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm definitely thinking about that stuff a lot. I mean, that was always, I grew up in southern Brooklyn, kind of, near Coney Island, and the city, New York City, Manhattan, we always just called it the city, was, it's like 40, 45 minutes away by train. And, it was the world away. It's wild for people to kind of you know, think about that. I think they think New York City, and they think it's, you're just kind of, the city is yours, everything's close by, everything's accessible. But when you grow up there, I think especially, and you live kind of like in the outer boroughs or on the edges of things, it's another world. And that's, I mean, I think that's definitely always something I'm thinking about in my work. And yeah, I think I have, I mean, I think a movie like this in particular is very much kind of, as I said, just kind of in the back of my mind, and the book, of course, in the back of my mind, kind of constantly when I'm working on stuff, thinking about characters who feel trapped in their small worlds, who feel, you know, I mean, a lot of my stuff kind of takes place in kind of, you know, crumbling houses and old kitchens, and, you know, it's just the city's right there, everything, you know, everything is right there, but people are kind of stuck. And that's something I've always been fascinated by, because I think also, you know, New York City is a place that people always think of as a place to escape to. And I'm always thinking about it, having grown up there, I think, as a place to get away from and escape from. So that's kind of something that I think I'm, you know, a way that a book and film like this kind of haunt my imagination when I'm writing.
Yeah. The way, excuse me, the way in which your characters navigate the neighborhood, sometimes as the reader, we forget that we're actually in a radius of just a few city blocks. And it reminds me also that in the film, you know, they have these derby races within this ballroom,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you realize that how much mileage is being covered within this very small kind of closed world.
Yeah, that's a really interesting. I hadn't made that connection, but that definitely, you know, that definitely feels true to me. I mean, you know, just to have these characters kind of, yeah, just haunting the same like 10 or 15 block radius for their whole lives, and to be just, you know, not far away from a host of other opportunities or new lives, you know. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's, I mean, it's a big one for me. And I saw the movie when I was pretty young. And, you know, I think it was also, I mean, I probably should have said this at the beginning when you asked why I chose it, but I think it was one of those movies for me, you know, you have those experiences as a teenager where you're engaging with something and you're engaging with art, and there's kind of the stuff you're being taught in school or the stuff that's kind of very mainstream. And then there's the stuff that you see it and you just feel like somebody told you the truths for the first time. And I think that was kind of my experience with this movie. It was like, oh yeah, this feels like what the world is really like. Like this is the truth. You know, this movie gets at something. Because I did see the movie before I read the book. So, and then I think I feel that even more with the book in some capacity, which I think the book has a, I think the book has a, if I have a criticism of the movie, it's mainly that I think some of the kind of dark humor of the book is tamped down a little bit. I think the book is funnier. I think Gloria is funnier in the book. And I think she's my favorite character in, you know, in fiction, and maybe my favorite all-time character in fiction. And I think Jane Fonda is wonderful in the movie, but I do think there's something in the movie that's taken away from her that exists in the book to some extent.
But when you say that the film reveals somehow the truth, it seems to me that what you're saying is that the film is about something else than what it appears to be. Am I correct in thinking this? And if so, what do you think it is about? Is it about the economic crisis? Is it about the class structure? Do you have some readings that you'd like to share with us about what it's supposed to mean?
I mean, I don't, you know, like Sidney Pollack said in that commentary track, like you can pretty easily be seduced by the symbolism of it. And I think it can apply to anything. You know, I mean, it can apply to the American dream, you know, which you're, you know, when you're in high school taking, you know, literature classes, that's what you're being kind of said, you know, like these are stories about the American dream. And so I think that this was a work that kind of shattered illusions of that, on some level, but it could also, especially in the film, they make some changes, some kind of fairly drastic changes from the book, especially at the end where, like, you know, you find out the contest, the marathon is basically rigged. Like, even if you win, you're going to, you know, you're going to have to pay all these expenses. That doesn't happen in the book. The guys who run the contest in the book are a little bit more fair, and they wind up having to end the marathon for kind of health reasons, and they split the prize money between all the remaining couples. It's a very different thing. So the movie really drives home the point of, like, you know, it could represent religion, organized religion. It could represent the government. It could represent anything. I mean, you know, and if you grew up in any sort of world where you felt trapped or, you know, restricted by those things, then you're going to feel that in the movie for sure, I think.
And talking about trapped, and to come back to the comparison with your own work, even though both have this notion of being trapped and being caught somehow in a web, it seems to me that your work is much more optimistic in the end than what we see in this film, which is close to absolute despair. And thinking about the film, I was thinking a lot about Camus, about this idea that about the absurdity of life that is leading nowhere, and that the only solution, in a sense, is to commit suicide, which is what she, what Jane Fonda's character does at the end. But
yeah,
in my feeling is that your work, even though it has some similarities with this, is also much more on the side of light than that of darkness.
Yeah, well, I think that's been kind of a developing thing for me. Because I think in the beginning, and if I had, you know, I started publishing novels when I was in my mid-30s. And I think my first novel, Gravesend, is probably the darkest of my books. And I think it's progressively gotten a little bit. And I don't know if that's just like having kids and kind of trying to look for some hope that I didn't previously feel. You know, I mean, a lot of days I don't feel it, but I think I am more and more kind of searching for it. It's also kind of the influence of some other works that I really respond to. There's a writer named Willie Vlautin who I really love. He wrote Motel Life and Northline and Lean on Pete and a bunch of other books. And I'm always amazed by, you know, his books are incredibly sad, and they tend to, in some ways, both small and large, kind of bend towards hope a little bit. And I'm always blown away by his ability to do that. So I think in recent books, especially, I've been trying to kind of take that model on a little bit more, just for, I don't know, for my own well-being, I guess. Because it's easy to see, you know, I mean, I think especially like when I published Gravesend and the kind of failed novels I wrote before that, I was really leaning into kind of nihilism and so it was kind of, you know, it was only so far you can go with that, I think, in terms of building a novel, especially if you're going to keep at it. You know, I mean, I can't have every novel end, you know, in with despair and with just kind of utter devastation, even if that sometimes is my instinct.
Are you familiar with the rest of the filmography of Sidney Pollack?
The rest of his filmography?
Yes, are you familiar with his other films, and do you have any favorites?
Yeah, I was looking at his filmography this morning because I think he's somebody I've always liked. But I was trying to think, are there other films of his that I love as much as this one? You know, certainly there are films I've seen and loved. So it's been a while. Like, it's been a while since I've seen Tootsie and, you know, and 3 Days of the Condor. I remember liking both of those films quite a bit. I haven't seen, I mean, I remember The Firm. I mean, The Firm was a big deal when I was a kid. I haven't seen that since it came out. I like Jeremiah Johnson a lot. I think that's one of his other films that I really love. And The Yakuza, I love. The Yakuza is another, that's a big favorite. I mean, I'm a big Paul Schrader fan, so The Yakuza is probably, I mean, that would probably be my other favorite film of his. Trying to think, what else is there? I haven't seen, there's a bunch of them I haven't seen in a while. Bobby Deerfield, I haven't seen in forever. I know people are kind of split on that one, but yeah, but I would say this one and the Yakuza and then probably 3 Days of the Condor. And those are the big ones for me.
I was wondering actually if Sidney Pollack isn't this kind of huge figure that we somehow are starting to forget today. For me, or like I think people of my generation and older, he feels like someone who was sort of always there and always
Yeah.
doing something, producing something, writing something. And I wonder about kind of the present generations and younger people, because I was reading that They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Did really well at the box office in 1969. It went to Cannes in 1970. But I think there's a tendency to really forget this film today. I'm grateful to you because I discovered it thanks to you. I hadn't seen the film before. I'm just wondering, I mean, do you know other people who appreciate the film? Are you always the only guy in the room who loves it, or?
Yeah, I feel like I don't know, I guess people know it. I feel like people know it a little bit. I mean, it did, you know, it's in that weird kind of window where it got nominated for a ton of Academy Awards. And so it was, you know, I think if you like are looking at that era of film, like, which is probably my favorite era of film, like 67 to 75 or thereabouts. I mean, it's a kind of, I mean, probably not now as well known as movies like The Graduate and Bonnie and Clyde and even Midnight Cowboy, but still, I mean, it still is up there as a film that kind of gained that sort of recognition in that unusual time where films like this could be celebrated, when films like this were attractive to actors like Jane Fonda. And like, you know, so yeah, I mean, I don't think general audiences probably know it much anymore at all. But I mean, you know, I think people kind of have to seek it out. But it did do, yeah, you're right, it did do well. I think it, you know, grossed like three times what it cost and got nominated for, I think it's kind of famously like, you know, movie that, one of those movies that got nominated for a ton of awards except for Best Picture. And Gig Young won for it, you know, one supporting actor. And so, I mean, it's got some, probably gets some attention just for that reason still, as it was a movie that was, you know, noticed and kind of in that way. But yeah, I wish more people knew it. And I think people know the book to some extent still, because it's, you know, it's part of that. Well, I have a couple of different copies of it, but it's included in that Library of America, like five great crime novels of the 30s and 40s collection. So I think people, because of that, people kind of register as being up there with, you know, the other stuff, you know, the James M. Cain, Postman Always Rings Twice, and whatever else is in that collection. I can't remember, probably.
While watching the film, it reminded me of, it made me think of another film from the same era. I don't exactly remember what year it was released in exactly, but that's Rollerball. I don't know if you agree with this, but I think there is this same despair linked to a sport that is played in a closed arena. And also it made me think of a newer film, which is The Hunger Games. And I think there's really something about the hunger and the poverty of the people there who are almost thrown into a gladiator arena for the pleasure of the people watching. I don't know if you agree with this or if you see other films that are linked possibly to They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, Rollerballs, that's a great one. I mean, I didn't make that. I love that movie, and I never made that connection in my head. But even visually, it's very kind of similar. You know, the Derby races are kind of like a prototype for the scenes in that movie that are the Rollerball scenes. Yeah, and I think the Hunger Games is just so. I mean, I feel like that's kind of. Yeah, I mean, I think that's working with all those kind of, you know, stories that came before it, that whether it's, you know, the lottery or Battle Royale or, you know, anything that kind of feels like it's pitting desperate people against each other. So yeah, that's an interesting connection. I hadn't thought of that one. I don't know. I would be surprised if I heard that was actually an influence on either Suzanne, is that the writer Suzanne Collins or the filmmakers, but that's definitely an interesting collection. Connection. I can't think of anything, you know, specifically. I mean, I do think there are other, I mean, I think the ways I kind of make connections with this film with other works are through the character of Gloria. I was thinking, you know, I definitely respond to a certain type of character, and she's somebody who makes me think of, you know, and I have this kind of assembly of favorite fictional characters, and I'm realizing they're a type, like, you know, and she's one, and Barbara Loden's Wanda is a big one, and I think they have a lot in common, those two characters. Jennifer Jason Leigh and Georgia, you know, is somebody I really think about all the time. What was the other? There was one other one I was thinking of that kind of jumped to mind. Oh, and Anne Savage and Detour, Vera and Detour. Like, these are all characters that, you know, I list these movies and these performances as my favorites, and I'm like, oh, they're kind of the same. They're variations on the same kind of character in some ways. So I think those are ways that I kind of connect it with other films through that character and through that performance.
Would you say that you build your fiction based on characters or on situations or differently? Do you have a way that you usually use to create the fictions you write?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's always character and place. Kind of, you know, I'm generally writing about where I'm from, and, you know, kind of most of my books are set in or around my neighborhood. So I'm kind of just, I start there. I typically start there, and then I build from the characters I kind of put in motion in that place. So yeah, those are the places that's the stuff that's always kind of been a starting point for me. It's been much harder to learn the other stuff, the plot stuff, and the, you know, that's not something that comes as naturally to me, or not something, because I think generally, like, if it was up to me, you know, and I guess it is ultimately up to me, but if I didn't care about, like, trying to sell books at all, I would probably just have characters existing in a place, you know, that's what's fascinating to me, you know, and building the drama from there instead of relying on, you know, plot mechanics. But I usually give in to that in some ways, and then I try to do as much with that as I can. And I do think, you know, again, listening to that Sydney Pollack commentary, I was struck by, you know, one of the things I like to do to myself as a writer is kind of put limitations on myself. And I think, you know, you feel that in this film, you feel that in the book too, like the space, you know, the event kind of limits, you know, what can happen, really. So the drama has to unfold in a relatively small frame. And I like that stuff too. You know, I think, I know, used to know a poet, this guy Donald Junkins, who said, he was talking about poetic forms, and he said, form is just the pressure you put on a poem. I've always thought that for, like, you know, situations too. I'm kind of like, you know, I can't, as a writer, I can't handle big situations and, you know, jumping around and all over the place and all through time. Like, that's not something I can do. It's not to say I can't appreciate it as a viewer or a reader. I can, but I can't do it as a writer. So I like, you know, typically limited space, limited time frame, and that's the kind of stuff that really I can work well within. And it's that pressure, that tension that results from it often can kind of inform the tension, the drama.
And you're obviously a cinephile, so I'm curious, when you're watching films, are you also very character driven? Is that what you're looking for when you watch a film? Or are there other aspects of the filmmaking process that you're also really looking to tap into when you consider something a good film?
I mean, that's a good question because I'm kind of all over the place. So I think I have a lot of different things I respond to. Primarily, I probably do respond most to the character pieces and kind of, you know, and all the stuff I was just talking about. Like, you know, I love John Cassavetes' movies. You know, I mean, I love characters just kind of yelling at each other a lot and kind of the drama, you know, the human drama kind of that. So that's definitely probably one of the main things. But I also, I mean, I love, you know, as far as film goes, I love thinking about the stuff that, you know, can only happen in that medium, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are films that I love, and this is maybe an example of this, you know, this is not a, I mean, it's kind of a visually lovely movie, but it's not like a, you know, groundbreaking looking movie. I mean, it's shot in a way that's, I mean, it's on a soundstage, it's pretty small scale, almost stagey at times, you know. So I do respond very much to, you know, stuff that can only happen, like this is the only way this story could be told this exact way. I mean, it's why, you know, I think I love David Lynch so much. I mean, I think there's something about David Lynch that's so kind of tethered to the medium. Like, this couldn't exist as a book. This couldn't exist in some other capacity, you know? So, and I feel the same way. I mean, I feel the same way about silent films a lot. Sometimes I think that that's the most exciting era of films in a lot of ways. I watch a lot of that, and that's something I've kind of had to teach myself over the years to appreciate. I think, you know, it took me a while, even from a young age, I was watching stuff from the 30s and 40s, but it wasn't until I was a little older that I really came to an appreciation for silent cinema. And that's really an era where you see people experimenting with the form and doing things that you couldn't do any other way. And so that's something I really, really respond to and love. But yeah, I don't know. I'm all over the place in my taste and can never tell. I like, you know, I like dumb action movies occasionally. I like, you know, just whatever. There's something, if there's something for me to connect to, or if there's an actor I particularly love, you know, I'll make some connection to it. I try to like things, you know, I try not to hate things. So I'm always looking for that connection. Doesn't always happen, but you know, I'm always looking for that.
And in They Shoot Horses Down There, do you have a favorite moment, a favorite scene that really struck you?
Well, you know, I gotta say, rewatching it this time, and it kind of hurts me to say it because I love Gloria so much as a character. I think the scene with Susanna York's Alice in the shower, her and Gig Young, is just such an incredible scene. And her performance in the film, I think, is incredible. You know, that's not a character that really exists in the book. And so that was something that really kind of, I don't know, something about this viewing made me really just made that character and her performance kind of hit hard, or hit harder than it has in the past. So yeah, might be that right now. Some of my favorite scenes in the book are not in the movie, which also I kind of feel that absence sometimes. I love the opening of the book when they meet, and you kind of see this. The Gloria character has some just incredible lines. Where one of her first lines to Robert is, you know, he asks her if she wants to go sit on a bench in the park, and she just says something like, "Yeah, let's go sit down and hate a bunch of people." And she kind of soon after that, she's telling a story about, I think it's her father who died in the war, and she says something like, "I wish I could die in a war." And you just miss, that's some stuff I missed with that character in the movie, I think. But yeah, I love that Susanna York scene, and Gig Young's amazing in that scene too, I think.
Yeah, and what about this opening scene in the film where we witness the horse being shot? How does the book treat that, and how do you feel about the differences between the film and the book with regards to that metaphor of the horse that goes down?
It's very. I was just rereading in my cram session. I was rereading that Pauline Kael review, and she's very hard on that scene, which is interesting. She says it is weird in retrospect, revisiting her review. It's kind of a weird thing. It doesn't look like it looks in the book. In the book, it's like a beloved old plow horse named Old Nellie, and he tells that story to Gloria, and so it's a different thing. Like, the horse is still connected to the plow, and it goes down and breaks its leg. In the movie, Pauline Kael says something like, "It looks like just men hunting a horse or something." So it's kind of strange. I don't know. I don't know that. Like, I'm trying to put myself in the mindset of the first time I saw it without having read the book. I don't know that it struck me as unusual as a teenager, but now. Yeah, it hits a little, something a little off about it or something compared to the book. The book treats that more effectively, I think.
But there's something very Edenic about this scene, I think. I mean, it really is something,
Yeah.
a moment from which humanity has fallen, and you don't have this lyricism anymore in the arena, do you?
No, I think that's a good point. Yeah. You're talking about the horse,
Yes,
the horse. And of course, I mean, I love the visual echo at the end with her kind of falling into the field. I mean, I think that's really beautiful. And that makes it work, I think, really well. No, it's a, definitely an interesting choice. It's also, I mean, little things bug me, because in the movie he says, I think the Robert character says he's from Chicago in the movie, whereas in the book he's from Arkansas, which it just feels a little different to me. Like, what is this idyllic, like, country childhood that he's having in Chicago? I mean, it could be somewhere else, but yeah, outside of Chicago, I guess. But that kind of bugs me about it too. But yeah, it's definitely, I don't think it's a problem. I think it's just one of several things from an adaptation standpoint that kind of irks me a little bit or puzzles me a little bit. The bigger one is the kind of, excision of the Hollywood, story. It's still present somewhat in the movie, but in the book, you really feel like these are two people who have come to Hollywood to try to make it as actors, and they're really, they're failing. They can't get anywhere. They can't get extra roles. They can't get in at central casting. They just, they're kind of at the end of their rope, and that's kind of missing from the book in a significant way, I think. And it's also, I mean, it's a huge theme of McCoy's other work too. I think it was his next novel after this, is I Should Have Stayed Home, which is an even more kind of brutal Hollywood novel. I mean, it really goes, I mean, this kind of strays from that because it's focused on the dance marathon, but that goes really in depth on kind of the sordid underbelly of Hollywood of the 30s. So.
I was thinking about the dance marathon itself as a symbol and as an important moment, and about the way contemporary audiences relate to it. Do you think there is something today in our culture, in our society, that might somehow echo these dance marathons and that reproduce this same sort of exploitation, nihilistic exploitation somehow, the people who take part of it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm sure there are a lot of things that people could kind of make that connection with. The first thing that jumped to mind for me was the gig economy, just kind of, just that kind of floating around, looking for job to job, and trying to make ends meet, just piecing it together little by little, you know, and you can feel that I don't think that, you know, I think there's probably a lot of jobs and kind of situations people are in where, you know, desperation is kind of at the heart of it.
Mm. To continue the thread about David Lynch, and connecting this to what you just
it was coming.
Sorry,
yeah.
And to connect it to what you just said, I was thinking, I just thought about season 3 of Twin Peaks, which was an answer Mark Frost and Lynch said partly to the 2008 economic crash. And I think that somehow this is also an echo of the 1929 crash that is found in the film. Do you think one could read season 3 as something of an echo to They Shoot Horses Down There?
That's a really fascinating connection. I was thinking about it too in terms of spaces, you know, I mean the kind of the lodges and you know, yeah, I mean I think there's probably some connection. I mean I feel like I'm always trying to connect things to the return in particular and looking for influences and, you know, things that Lynch might have been building out of and Frost. Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of makes some sense for sure. I'm trying to think, I was going to say something else about, I mean, yeah, I think Lynch is certainly drawn to that era too. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that kind of, you know, always returning to, you know, the kind of the roots of, you know, those stories. I mean, the Alice character feels like a Lynch character in a lot of ways. I mean, there's some direct echoes of, she almost looks like Naomi Watts and Mulholland Drive at times, you know, so there's something there maybe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's a similar feeling of damnation that I feel in his work and in that film. I mean, the people are really trapped in, I mean, Lynch talks about the Kali Yuga, you know, this era in Hinduism that is the end of several cycles and that is going downhill. And that's a strong feeling I had watching that film. And that's also something that is very present in season 3. So yeah, that was just an idea I had while you were talking about this.
Yeah.
Just wanted
no, I think that's great. That's a great connection. That makes a lot of sense, I think.
Mm.
But it's always really interesting for me as someone with a dance background to see how dance is used in film for different symbols. I think it with Lynch, you know, it's something very surreal that kind of transports us to another place. And here it might transport us as well, but maybe to a very dark place. And it's always striking to me that this activity in this film, They Shoot Horses, Don't They?, that this social dance that is something that's done normally for pleasure, something that you do to entertain, to be social with someone else, has become this really exhausting kind of damned activity. And I just think that's really interesting and special in this film, because dance is usually used in a much lighter way as something that's really gonna take us into a dream state, or that's going to be something really positive. And here it's just the opposite. I mean, it takes us really down into the ground, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I mean, you know, and I don't have any, you know, background in that and thinking about that, so I'm sure that's extra kind of fascinating to you. But it's yeah, I mean, it's totally just, I mean, it's not glamorous at all. It's really kind of just this brutal thing that people are putting themselves through for, you know, some meals and some, you know, this, the promise of this reward at the end. But yeah, it's interesting to think about how that compares to our kind of notions of what a dance contest might generally be like.
But they're really treated like animals, aren't they?
Yeah,
they're just there to be fed and to entertain the people in the room, and that's it.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's even amped up even more in the movie probably than the book. I mean, there is a little bit more humanity, I think, in the book on the part of the organizers of the marathon, but But it is, yeah, it's a little bit more of a, it feels like a little bit more of a madhouse in the book though, too, because there's like, you know, some of the other stuff that's cut out is there's a gangster in hiding that's participating in the dance marathon, and there winds up being a shooting at the bar, the Palm Garden, which gets mentioned in the movie, but I don't think you ever see. And then, you know, so there's a lot more kind of that sort of chaos of like the crowd that it's drawing in, and the older woman in the crowd who you meet a couple of times in the movie, Mrs. Layden, I think her name is. She, you know, she's got a bigger part in the book, and she winds up getting hit by a stray bullet in this kind of shootout towards the end of the book. That's like a bar fight gone bad. So there's that sort of chaos element too. The movie feels chaotic in a little bit of a different way, I think.
Mm. And as a writer yourself, would you have liked things to develop slightly differently in the story as it is adapted by Sidney Pollack? Or do you think that he did a good job in the end adapting, turning it that way?
Yeah, I think he did a great, I mean, I think he did a great job. I mean, I don't know how, you know, I think it's tough to capture some of the feeling of the book. I don't know how it would be possible. I mean, that kind of, that dark humor element that I was talking about. I mean, I think, you know, he makes the decision to kind of erase it, sort of. I mean, there's a little touch of it here and there, but he mostly makes a decision to erase it, I think, and it's probably smart. But I think, yeah, I think he does a really good job. You know, and I'd be hard pressed to see how somebody could have adapted it more effectively. I mean, they are different. They're different objects, and you know, and I think they kind of have to be. It's hard to adapt something totally faithfully. So, I mean, I don't know. You know, the book is, again, you know, so spare and so quick. It's like 110 pages or something, and the movie is kind of bigger and you know, more of an ensemble kind of than the book is. And I think, you know, those are all interesting decisions. I think a lot of that kind of came from his, I feel like, you know, well, the other writer, the script was written by two writers, adapted by two writers, James Poe and I think Robert Thompson is the other guy. I mean, Thompson worked closely with Pollack, and I think Pollack's kind of background, you know, they talk a lot about his time in the actor's studio and his background working with actors. And I think he brought that kind of ensemble. He brought kind of his character actors in to play some of the smaller roles. And yeah, I think that stuff all is really even better in the movie than in the book. You get sense of some of those characters in the book, but certainly not as thorough a sense.
And as hard as it is to believe, our time is almost up. And there's a question that we usually like to ask, which is there something you wish we would have asked you about the film? Is there something you wanted to say about the film that you haven't yet had the chance to?
Trying to think. I don't think there's anything that you all didn't ask me that I would have liked to ask. I mean, I think one of the things I'm always fascinated, you know, again, listening to that Pollack commentary this morning, I was at the beginning of it, he was talking about how this had been kind of a film that people wanted to make for a while before it got to him. And, you know, so I think James Poe, the guy who wrote the original version of the script, was going to make it as his directorial debut. That was, but I was reading somewhere online that there were other versions earlier than that. So that's one of the things I always like thinking about and bringing up, like the movies that didn't happen, that didn't get made. And apparently there was a version in the early 50s that came close to happening that was going to be produced by Charlie Chaplin and star his son, Sidney Chaplin, and Marilyn Monroe. I'm assuming Marilyn Monroe is Gloria, which, you know, it could have been really interesting. So yeah, I don't know, that I kind of had that tucked away in the back of my mind. this morning, just as an interesting little side note. But yeah, it's I don't think there's anything else.
That sounds like one of those dream casts of, you know, it's always interesting to hear about those. It's almost like a ghost story, those films that didn't get made, but you've got traces of the design or ideas for the casting, and you think, oh, what could it have been? But it has to
I know.
our imagination.
Yeah, I get obsessed with it when I, especially if it's like a movie that I don't think is super successful. Like this movie, I think is great, but I think the movie Death Wish, for instance, it's okay as a movie, I think, but the book it's based on by Brian Garfield is amazing, and the original version of that movie was supposed to be directed by Sidney Lumet and starring Jack Lemmon and Henry Fonda instead of Mel Thompson and Vincent Gardini. So that's one that always jumps out in my mind of like, oh my God, what would that movie have been like?
Dream team.
Yeah.
And for the They Shoot Horses, don't they? If the film was to be remade today, is there someone you would like to be the director or someone to be the main actors?
Oh man, that's a good question. Who could pull this off? I feel like the Safdie brothers could do like a good job with just this. And I don't know if they're, I think they maybe broke up, but whatever, it's okay for the purposes of this conversation. I'll imagine they didn't. I think they could really, you know, they could amp up the tension that, you know, the way they do in Uncut Gems and Good Time, and you could really feel the, I mean, I think they'd be expert at kind of getting across the desperation. That'd be a really interesting match for me. I'm trying to think about actors or, you know, who could play these roles. I don't know off the top of my head who I would cast. I don't know. Yeah, that's tough. I feel like
you can have anyone.
Yeah. I know, that's tough, man. I don't know. I don't know why my mind is going to Kristen Stewart for Gloria part. I don't know why. Nothing specific. I feel like that could be interesting. I'm trying to think of Robert. I don't know. There's that character that was I think Pollock wanted Warren Beatty for that originally. But he, you know, Robert Sarazen is great in it, I think. I know that Pauline Kael had problems with that performance. I'm trying to think who, I don't know if there's like a Michael Sarazen, I'm sorry, characters, Robert. I don't know if there's like a, I feel like it'd have to be someone kind of unknown or something, you know, to get across with that character gets across and has to get across. And I think that's what Sidney Pollack said ultimately about Sarazen, is that like he's able to do something that, you know, he's got to make you believe that he would be kind of naive enough or willing enough to just kind of, you know, essentially euthanize Gloria.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'll keep thinking. I'm sorry. That's a disappointing disappointing answer.
No, no, yeah. It comes in pieces. We've got a good foundation there, yeah. Some ideas.
Starting base, definitely.
Yeah.
Can we ask you what you're currently working on?
I just finished a new novel, so it'll be out here next year, February 2025. And set in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, kind of in four different pieces, and Southern Brooklyn, kind of sprawling kind of ensemble cast, kind of centered around this one block. The name of the book is Saint of the Narrow Street, which is the name of the block.
Uh-huh.
So, I don't know when it'll be out in France, but I hopefully some point next year too, but we'll see.
Great. We'll have to look for that, and we're excited to read your newest work. Thank you so much, William Boyle, for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. It was great to meet you and great to talk to you, and I'm excited to be on, and yeah, thanks.
Yeah. Thank you very much, and I think you'll be coming to France soon, won't you?
Yeah, October 2nd to 14th, but I don't have specific details yet. I just know that I'll be there then. But yeah, I'll be a couple of festivals and I think doing like 3 or 4 bookstore or library events too.
Wonderful.
And for our listeners elsewhere, will you also be touring in the US or anywhere else? Or what can you tell us about your signing?
I don't have any. I'm going to be at an event in, actually, this is Lynch related, so this is cool. I'll be at an event in Dallas in about a month in April. I do a lot of writing for a journal called Southwest Review, which is based out of Dallas. I write a film column for them too, called I Wake Up Streaming. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be there at that festival with a bunch of writers and musicians. One of the writers who will be there is one of my heroes, Barry Gifford. Mm-hmm. And you know, we're going to be, I don't know if I can go into details yet because they haven't announced, they've announced who's going to be there, but they haven't announced what we're doing yet. But there's some cool stuff lined up with Barry, I'll say. And I'm excited to be part of it. So that's the only thing I'm doing here anytime soon. I'm also doing where I live in Oxford, Mississippi. In early April, I'm doing a Noir at the Bar event with a bunch of great writers. And then I don't probably when my new book comes out early next year, I'll be hopefully, you know, doing some stuff in New York and maybe out west. But I don't have anything specific yet.
We'll drop the link to your website on the podcast link so that everybody can check things out as things come up. We can follow along.
And if people want to read your writing about film, is Southwest Review available online?
Yeah, all my columns are just online. It's not in their print mag, so it's just every month. Sometimes I take a month off, but usually it's once a month. I should have a new one coming out soon. So I've been doing that for a few years. It's fun to, you know, one of the rare opportunities I get to kind of write about movies outside of just Letterboxd or wherever. So. It's nice. And it's not, I'm not like, you know, I'm not a film critic by any stretch. And it's just, you know, it's just me writing about stuff I like generally.
Well, all the better.
Thank you again, William Boyle. It was wonderful to have you on the After Images podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was great to meet you both and great to talk to you. I'm sorry. I hope this background noise isn't coming through. There's something happening outside that I don't know what it is right now.
Oh, no
problem.
Don't worry.
No, it's fine.
On our side.
Okay. Okay, good.
Thank you for listening to After Images. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow After Images podcast on social media.
After Images.